This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. President Joe Biden will be speaking at the White House later this hour regarding the unfolding tensions with Russia and Ukraine. We'll bring you special NPR coverage live beginning at 3:30. But first, it's Tuesday, which means it's Ask the Doctors. And what does it mean that the FDA postponed a decision on vaccines for kids under 5? Should you be trying to get a second booster? Is that even allowed? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus questions, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So while you prepare your questions, we want to briefly pay a visit to a local hospital to check in on youth mental health.
The last 2 years have dramatically changed young people's experiences at home, at school, and in their communities. It's not just the unfathomable number of deaths or the instability. It's also the pervasive sense of uncertainty and the nagging sense of fear. It's the isolation from loved ones, from friends, and from communities at a moment where human support systems are irreplaceable and more needed than ever before.
That is a warning earlier this month from U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy in testimony in front of the Senate Finance Committee. We have seen that increased mental health strain on youth here in the Commonwealth. In the first 7 months of the pandemic alone, mental health ER visits for kids 12 to 17 up 31%, according to the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Our capacity can't keep up. In fact, a new survey from the Association for Behavioral Health Care says 640 clinical staff vacancies in 124 outpatient clinics statewide. The result? It's called boarding. Kids waiting in emergency departments days or sometimes weeks for a treatment option to become available. Boarding happened before the pandemic, but like so much else, COVID made it worse. And that, of course, means less capacity for other emergency needs, too. Yesterday, we talked to Christine Schuster, president and CEO of Emerson Hospital in Concord, about the increasing number of kids waiting in emergency rooms for psychiatric care. And we started by asking how many kids are currently boarding at Emerson.
Well, right now at Emerson, we have 6 boarders, and some of them are between 9 and 12, and others are up to 16.
So let's say we were colleagues of yours, and we heard you say the number 6. Should our response be a collective gasp of, oh my God, 6, are you kidding me? Or would we say, yeah, that tracks?
They would say, not only does it track, but wow, they only have 6. Our hospital has 12, 14, 22. So Emerson is a medium-sized community hospital, but the larger hospitals like UMass and Worcester and Children's Hospital have many more children boarding in their emergency departments, just waiting for inpatient placement or strong outpatient placement that just doesn't seem to exist today.
Was there ever a time when kids and adolescents did not board at emergency departments? If you came in with a mental health crisis as a young person, you weren't going to board.
The numbers were smaller pre-pandemic. So you may have a few children boarding here or there. But with the pandemic, the problem has gotten much worse. In addition, 7 inpatient hospitals for pediatric inpatient care have closed due to staffing issues. And there doesn't seem to be enough outpatient providers. So in the past, we may have been able to find a placement for 1 or 2 children. But when you have numbers that are in the double digits, it's very, very difficult to be able to place a child in the right setting for them to get better.
And how long is a child who is in emergency crisis, in mental health crisis, sitting in an emergency room waiting for treatment?
It varies from hospital to hospital and situation to situation. It can be a couple of days to a couple of weeks, and maybe even longer in some isolated situations.
There's a huge difference between a couple of days and a couple of weeks. I mean, as a parent, I think I would be frantic if we were talking about a couple of weeks.
Yes, as a parent, you would be. However, each of the hospitals has really put resources into making sure the child is safe in the environment while they wait, and that the family is well-informed as to what's happening. So we've had to take additional measures to make sure that we have clinical nurses who are specially trained to deal with children and children's issues around the clock, safety through security guards.
I hear you, but we also hear stories every day about staffing shortages in hospitals. Do you have those professionals available and consistently in place right now?
Each hospital is experiencing a staffing shortage in different areas. But one of the things all hospitals do is their best to keep patients safe, especially in the emergency room where these children may be boarding. So we may use extenders, so security guards, the National Guard, whomever is available and trained to be able to help us keep the patient safe and also to make sure we're in communication regularly with the family. We also have a pediatric intervention team, and so they're specialized nurses that spend time with the family and may play games with them, may have help them select movies and things to pass the time. And so being able to use our other resources, not just our clinical resources, has really helped to mitigate the gravity of the situation.
Without revealing details, because I understand people's privacy is important, can you give us a profile of a child who has boarded at Emerson's ED emergency department over the last few weeks? What did they come in presenting with symptoms? What were they experiencing? What did they need?
So there may be a overly aggressive behavior, violent behavior, even things like cutting. And so when those children put themselves in harm's way or put others, like other members of their family, siblings, parents, pets, then that's when we know it's time for them to come in and for us to do full evaluation and to be able to recommend the next level of care for them, be it outpatient or an inpatient facility.
So something's broken. Something's not working, whether it's our ability to scale up as the problem gets worse due to the pandemic or, you know, loss of, for example, pediatric inpatient facilities, seven facilities that used to take inpatient that don't. What is broken in the system, and what do you think we need to do to fix it?
So for sure, we could use more inpatient pediatric beds. That's a given. We do have beds online and licensed in Massachusetts. But as you alluded to earlier, with the staffing shortage, it's been a little bit more difficult for us to send patients to those facilities because they aren't open. So hopefully over time, those places will be staffed and we'll have some place to go. Also, there's a lack of outpatient mental health professionals, everything from social workers to counselors to psychiatrists to psychologists. And if we had more of those, perhaps if the system was accessed earlier by the patient, by the child, by their family, then perhaps it wouldn't escalate to an emergency situation requiring an inpatient stay.
Are you seeing the same kids, you know, two, three, four times?
Yes, we definitely do see, you know, repeat patients for sure.
And let's take a snapshot in time. In your professional judgment, how long would it take us to scale up our resources to meet the demand in emergency departments right now? Is it 2 months? Is it 6 months? Is it 5 years?
I think it's more like 4 to 6 months. If we could get the current units that aren't open and staffed, then I think that would go a long way toward clearing out the emergency departments and getting these children the care that they need.
Christine, what keeps you awake at night?
Is another variant coming? Will I have enough staff to care for folks when they come through my doors? And will we ever get back to normal? Or is this the new normal and we have to learn to adjust to it?
That is Christine Schuster, president and CEO of Emerson Hospital in Concord, also chair-elect for the Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association. Christine, thanks for your work and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So sticking with the pandemic, it is time to ask the doctors. New guidance this afternoon from the state's Department of Public Health. They're now recommending only the unvaccinated and those at higher risk for severe disease wear masks indoors. Everyone else can put their masks away for now. The science does change. We do change as things go along. lots of change going on now. So what questions do you have about whether you need another booster, about whether you should wear a mask indoors, about whether your kid should wear a mask in school? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to ask your question. Joining us, Dr. Shira Doron, an attending physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Doron, welcome back.
Wonderful to be back.
And we have a new voice here, Dr. Luann Bruno-Murtha. She is the Chief of Infectious Diseases at Cambridge Health Alliance, with locations in Cambridge, Somerville, and Everett. Dr. Bruno-Murtha, welcome.
Thank you.
So we have the lines lighting up. I am going to go straight to a question here. Again, 800-423-8255 or tweet us at Radio Boston. We have Steve on the line in Needham. Steve, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually tested positive. I was feeling sick and took an at-home test, tested positive for COVID last Monday. I isolated for 5 days, was feeling a bit better, went to take a PCR test at a testing facility, and to my surprise, even though I was feeling better, the test came back positive. Now, a person called to discuss the test results with me. And they said that the PCR test is so sensitive that it can pick up a positive result up to 3 months after a person has successfully recovered. So my question is, if the test is capable of detecting results or detecting COVID in a person for 3 months after they are no longer infectious, no longer sick, then what does that mean about how we're supposed to interpret the infection numbers that we see in real time? Because we all see the graphs and stuff. So I'm wondering what that means in terms of how accurate the numbers we see actually coming out of PCR testing are about the current levels of infection in the population.
Thanks for the question, Steve. And by the way, I'm glad you're feeling better. Let's go to Dr. Shira Doron.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So we even see people test positive out to 4 months sometimes. And we don't actually know what makes somebody test positive for months versus weeks versus days. It's very mysterious. It does not reflect being contagious. And that's one of the reasons why there has been, one of many reasons why there has been this shift from focusing on PCR-based testing to focusing on antigen-based testing for this sort of public health purpose that we're really still using it for.
And excuse me for interrupting, but that's home tests. When you say antigen-based, do you basically mean home tests, Dr. Doron?
So there are antigen tests that people can use at home. Home tests are always antigen-based tests. There are lab-based antigen tests as well. But yes, we are shifting toward more home-based testing, which is antigen testing, which is also more closely correlated with that acute illness, that contagious phase of disease. It's not a one-to-one correlation, but it's more correlated. And so you're absolutely right that when we're just talking about PCR-based testing, we may be picking up infections that are old and no longer really relevant from a public health standpoint. Luckily, here in Massachusetts, we do have wastewater testing, particularly in the Boston area, that's very carefully monitored, that is a much better measure of how much COVID is out there. But again, you know, people may shed that PCR-based, you know, that DNA in their the genetic material in their feces for some time. It doesn't correlate with how many people are contagious right now. We have to take all the different data points and put them together to make a picture.
Okay, 800-423-8255 to ask your question of Ask the Doctors. We've got Rachel on the line in Westford. Rachel, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because my two-year-old has a heart condition. It's stable, but I work at public schools, and my daughter goes to public school. And we're just concerned if we had like an asymptomatic case, we're all vaccinated, but how contagious are we and how worried should we be about our little one?
Rachel, and I'm sorry, you may have said, but how old is your older child who's in public school?
She's 8 and she's vaccinated.
Thanks, Rachel.
With 2 shots.
Thank you. So let me turn here to Dr. Luann Bruno-Murtha. Dr. Bruno-Murtha.
Thank you, Rachel, for your question. So with regards to your two-year-old who's not yet eligible for vaccination and has a pre-existing condition that makes you a little bit more worried should your child get infected, it's great that you and your other child and hopefully everyone else in your household is fully vaccinated and up to date with their vaccines, because that's clearly one of the best things you could do to keep your unvaccinated child safe. In addition to that, you know, masking is another thing that you can do when you're in high risk settings. Your older child, I don't know what practices are in the school that your older child attends. If everyone's still masked, then that makes it easier for your older child to mask and keep her safe at school. The other thing I would recommend out of an abundance of caution, if you really want to be certain, is to do home testing on a regular basis. Certainly, if you have any type of symptom that's concerning, or you can even do regular screening after you've had a exposure that you're concerned about. So those are some of the recommendations I would make, but you've done a lot already to keep your younger child safe by being up to date in your vaccines.
Do we still have Rachel on the line?
Yeah, thank you.
Rachel, did that give you the information that you need?
It did. That helped. I appreciate the suggestions, and thank you again.
Great. Good luck, Rachel. Let's go now, 800-423-8255, to Sarah in Lunenburg.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah.
I'm worried because, tomorrow night our school committee is going to be looking at the issue of dropping the masks, and I feel very much like this is too early, and I have a couple questions. Number one, why is it being put down to, you know, people that aren't experts in public health to make these decisions? And why don't we have more wastewater testing? Because that seems to be like a really good metric to me. But our wastewater goes to Leominster and Fitchburg, and I don't think they're doing testing there.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Durone. I will turn to you here.
Yeah, so, you know, the issue of masks in school is probably the most polarizing and divisive issue of the pandemic to date. And there are going to be people who feel it's too early, and there are people who feel like it's way too late. And, you know, a lot of states are moving in this direction of treating COVID more like other viruses and moving in the direction of personal choice and personal responsibility. So I think, you know, there's no perfect right time, but what we have now is we have a couple things in our favor. We have a lot of immunity. We have widespread vaccination for everyone of school age, and we have a lot of immunity from prior infection. We have the supply chain having opened up so that there are good quality masks available so people can wear them for their own protection. And for a child, I wouldn't recommend an N95, but a well-fitting surgical mask, a KF94, KN95 can be a good option so that it matters much less what other people are doing. And then, you know, for older people, 12 and over, we have now pretty widespread availability of treatments. We have a lot of the oral agents here at Tufts Medical Center, a lot of monoclonal antibody for really anyone who needs them at this point. So, you know, all of those things mean that there is some rationale at this point for moving forward with a new phase of the pandemic, personal responsibility and treating it like other viruses.
800-423-8255 to ask your questions here on Radio Boston. Ask the doctors. We've got Patricia on the line in Rowley. Patricia, go ahead.
So my question was, I did contact tracing for 18 months with the Contact Tracing Collaborative. I was both as a contact tracer and a case investigator. So was in the thick of it for 18 months. My daughter is a student at UMass Lowell. Came home sick with symptoms, tested her on a home test. She tested positive. I tried contacting the LBOH in Lowell, the DPH, her school. Nobody wanted anything to do with a home test. And how are we getting a true picture of how many people are positive when they are no longer logging or tracing home antigen tests?
Thanks for the question, Patricia. I'll turn to Dr. Bruno Murtha here.
Thank you, Patricia, and thank you for your service during the pandemic. Yeah, as Dr. Durone had mentioned earlier, tests are just one metric, and there is no systematic way for monitoring home tests. We have no idea how many home tests are being performed and what the positivity rate is. That is just not being captured in any systematic way. And similarly, like like Steve mentioned in his first question, there are people that are having PCR tests that are in fact being carefully monitored that are no longer infectious. So it's one metric that needs to be taken in consideration with other metrics like hospitalization rates and death rates and like the wastewater data. So antigen testing, we are in this huge transition phase now toward antigen testing. So testing is not going to be as reliable as a metric as it's been in the past. And we should accept that because it's another tool in our toolbox that will help us manage as we come out of this pandemic.
Okay, we're going to do a lightning round. Steve in North Andover, quickly your question.
Oh, hello, thanks for taking the call. I'm a pediatrician and I've been watching the Pfizer vaccines that are being talked about for the under 5 year crowd. And I see that it seems that the doses work pretty effectively up to 2 years old, but between 2 years and just under 5 years, it was, I think, pretty clear that one dose didn't work and the second dose didn't work. And now they're testing a third dose. And it just seemed a lot more sensible to me rather than trying to counsel parents into, you know, three doses and it won't be effective for 3 to 4 months to just
Steve,
test
I'm
a higher dose that will be effective.
Great. There it is. Okay, thank you. And Dr. Drone, sorry, I don't mean to be short, Steve, but we are on a limited clock and I want to get you an answer to your question. So are we testing the right doses for that age group for Pfizer? Dr. Drone, briefly.
Maybe not. Well, clearly not for a two-dose vaccine, and they could have gone back to the drawing board and started over with new participants, but they decided that it would be quicker to go ahead and keep the existing participants and give them a third dose, and we expect that data in April and hopefully authorization in April.
So that was nice and tight. So just to clarify, Dr. Drone, you're saying they decided to continue with the current kids who had been being studied and give them more doses to see what that would do.
That's right.
Excellent. All right. I think that is all that we have time for now. I'm managing our clock a little bit because we're headed to special coverage. That's Ask the Doctors for today. Dr. Shira Derone is an attending physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Derone, always great to have you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And we had a new doctor today, Luann Bruno-Murtha, who is the chief of infectious diseases at Cambridge Health Alliance, which has locations in Cambridge, Somerville, and Everett. Did you enjoy your first Ask the Doctors?
Yes, I did. Thank you for having me.
It was great to have you, Dr. Bruno-Murtha. We'll talk to you again. All right, folks, that is our show for today. We have a short show today because we are turning now to NPR special coverage. We are awaiting an address from President Joe Biden on the ongoing tensions with Russia and Ukraine. We will turn to that coverage now, but tune in again tomorrow at 3 to talk to us. One of our subjects, how the doping scandal in Russian skating is affecting young skaters here in our community. That's tomorrow. We'll talk to you at 3 on Radio Boston.